Okay, let's talk about the nations here that threaten God's people. Again, we're talking about the Israelites of the Old Testament days in the land of promise, the land that was given to them by God to accomplish and fulfill His promise of redemption. One of the things that we need to remind ourselves of is really the land of promise becomes a land of fulfillment for one particular reason. And I want to point that out. In particular, Jerusalem. Jerusalem was very central and key to the promises of God, redemption being fulfilled. And anybody have a answer as to why Jerusalem? What was so significant about Jerusalem? Or become significant, maybe at the very beginning in Joshua's day and the judges enduring in even to the period of the first king of Saul. But by the time you get to King David, it really starts to become pointed toward the location of Jerusalem being significant for one particular reason. Anybody know? I bet you all know. Well, the temple's located there. Go up to Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. But what about, like, say, particularly prophets, like prophets like Isaiah and Micah started prophesying about the city of Jerusalem and a location there in fulfillment of one thing. Okay, a new name, Isaiah 66. But in particular, Jesus would talk about going to Jerusalem to the apostles and tarrying in Jerusalem. Isaiah chapter 2 verse 2 talks about the establishment of the house of the Lord being in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem becomes the location for the beginning of what? The church, the house of the Lord, the house of God as it's referred to in 1 Timothy 3:15 and many other passages. Of course, the house, the idea of the house, is a spiritual idea, a principle again. What does it mean when he's talking about the house of the Lord, even during Isaiah's day, 721 years or so before Christianity is established? What's Isaiah really talking about? A house, a literal physical house, or with brick and mortar, stone and wood? What's Isaiah really talking about? Yeah, the temple. The temple becomes what kind of a temple in the New Testament? Located physically in Jerusalem, but when we get to the New Testament, the temple of God, the house of God, begins and starts in fulfillment where? In Jerusalem. And then it goes everywhere. And we're taught very, very soon by Peter and the apostles that we are a spiritual priesthood, a royal priesthood. And that thing is important because of, again, geography and fulfillment of prophecy. We talk about Bible evidences and proof, and we're studying with new converts or people that might be potential new converts. We can go to the Old Testament scriptures and point these things out and show the significance of that land. But it's fulfilled now. You know, another thing that, again, is significant to the fulfillment of prophecy and the land of promise, the city of Bethlehem was the city of Bethlehem, a city with a lot of history, going back to Jacob. But that city becomes the location by prophecy, Micah 5, verse 2, of where the Messiah would be born, Bethlehem of old Judea, southern kingdom. And that's where, is it just a coincidence? You think about that. When Jesus was physically born of a virgin, and do you remember where Mary and Joseph were going on their way? And what happened on the way? It had something to do with the Romans. And enrollment, taxes, census, government during their day, and they were being faithful to the government, faithful to the empire of Rome. but also trying to be faithful Jews, Israelites. And on the way, guess what happens to Mary? She goes into labor, and she happens to be born in Bethlehem of Judea, according to the prophet. So this land becomes significant from the standpoint of evidences of being able to show people that Jesus is the right person, that the kingdom of God is established, that it's a spiritual house, as the prophet said, would be established in the mountains, going up to Jerusalem or Zion, reference to Jerusalem. And is it a mistake or just a mere coincidence that all this happens in the New Testament, that's fulfilled? Of course it's not. So Bible geography is important from that standpoint alone. We have to be able to understand the importance of the land. One of the things I've tried to point out in this study is that this is real history, though. It's real civilizations, real people. This is your history. This is my history, going back. You can't avoid it. And neither could these secular kings and people during these days. And so I want to talk a little bit more about this again. Now, this, of course, is the known civilized world of the Bible. You might be able to stretch out a little bit more going back towards Europe. Starting to really stretch out. There's some evidence that's being found out even today that some of the Roman soldiers, just the other day, I'm careful to establish this as concrete evidence, but the other day they found two Roman soldiers dating, they say, they think around the 2nd century AD, buried, and the, however they do this, DNA genetics that they determined were of a Chinese origin or an Asiatic type of origin. And that's really impressive because during history, what we have somewhat little information on is the movement towards the Asiatic countries like China, the Mongoliads and so forth. And a lot of people question it, but they no doubt just traveled. In fact, they traveled so far. Do you know Bible geography here? The American Indians, Native Americans in this country and all the way down to the Mayans and the Incans. Do you know what kind of DNA genetics they have? What they're related to? Yeah, Mongolia, they call them the Mongoliad. Asiatic bloodlines. No doubt about it. Which is another interesting thing relative to the story of Mormonism. Okay? Bible geography here helps us prove that Mormonism is false. You know why we know Mormonism is false in part? What did the Mormons, Joseph Smith and everybody, make up or fabricate and say the American Indians, they were who? They had this, they said that these American Indians were a lost tribe of who? Mm-hmm. Lost tribe of the Jews. Well, that's kind of interesting because the Jews, their bloodline, is it Asiatic? Is it Native American? No way. That's a scientific fact. You can determine that. It's like going to the blood bank and giving blood. Does it matter if you show up and say, oh, I just take my blood. Don't worry about what kind it is. It'll work with anybody. Not unless you're like, what, O negative or something, or O positive? Which, by the way, that's what my wife is. So she thinks she's important, you know. Anyway, now they call her all the time though, because she's got that blood that goes all over the place. But I think I'm like A positive or something, and they say you're just a negative and you can't give anyway. But blood is important, isn't it? Well, again, geographically speaking, we can go back and dig around and figure this stuff out. So again, the Mormons are false. I mean, the Native Americans were not a lost tribe of the Israelites. The Native Americans were Mongoliad in bloodline. That's a fact. They go back likely very simply back through Russia. And they came through that landmass that was probably frozen more then. The Eskimos. You go up there, the Inuits up in Alaska. They're related to the Native Americans. They're all connected. Anyway, it's pretty amazing. Stuff, but so I point all this out just to show you that the world was, again, a thriving place as God had created it to be. Talking about the captivity of Judah, we've already talked about the Assyrians and so forth. About 2586 through 516, you have a 70-year period of time, as prophesied by the prophets, Jeremiah in particular, in Jeremiah 25:12, several places, Jeremiah chapter 28, Jeremiah 29, that the people of God would be in captivity for 70 years. I want to show you, again, just by way of a reminder of how all this is connected. You start with the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, Ezra in particular, and what does Ezra say? Let me get back to my history. Look at Ezra chapter 1, verse 1 and following. And Ezra writes, after the captivity, during the period of restoration, or when the children of Israel are being released after this 70 years of captivity to the Babylonians. So look at chapter 1, Ezra chapter 1, just to show you the sequence. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the prophet, that might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. So there you have again a reference to Jerusalem and again the significance of all things being fulfilled. Now, I want to go look at the prophet of Daniel for a moment. Look at Daniel's prophecy, and let's just show all the turmoil that's going on during these days. Of course, Daniel chapter 1, chapter 2, Daniel being a part of the captives by the Babylonians. You start off in Daniel chapter 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came into Jerusalem and besieged it. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, living history, geographical people. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried and so forth. Right there is a reference to the instruments. Maybe the Ark of the Covenant was involved with this. Some people say the Ark of the Covenant was already gone by this time and lost to history. But we know... we know by concrete or architecture that there are structures in place showing this great captivity by the Babylonians, this great besiegement, and it shows them carrying off in one of the pictures, several of them actually, the lampstand. You remember the lampstand that was the menorah? That was so significant to the Hebrews or the Israelites. There are ancient reminders of this battle. And it shows them carrying the Israelites off into Babylonian captivity during Nebuchadnezzar's day and so forth. So very historical, very geographical. Like I said, they carry them, you know, come down here, besiege them and carry them back over in here. And this is where they're located before they'll come back during the restoration. The book of Ezra, Nehemiah. And I want to point that out. But did you remember there in Ezra that he was a Mede or a Persian? That Darius. Now let's look at the book of Daniel and remember that Daniel goes through three different kingdoms almost in captivity during this 70-year period of captivity. Daniel chapter 1, of course, shows the actual besiegement and captivity of Daniel and his friends. You get to chapter 2, Daniel interprets the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, which you remember the dream. Look at verse 31. He starts to, well, verse 19 is where he starts to actually get the revelation. And Daniel, of course, will interpret this dream. All the soothsayers and magicians couldn't do it. And Nebuchadnezzar wanted this dream interpreted. And in verse 31 of chapter 2, he talks about the great image, and he gives a clear interpretation. And what is the interpretation? Look at verse 44. The interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream is pretty interesting. The days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. I don't know that we understand how significant that passage is in principle. And I'm going to try to show you that as we talk about the Romans more, and how we still today, impacted by the Roman economy and the Roman government and the Roman philosophies, yet we are not Romans. But Rome had a great impact. This dream of Nebuchadnezzar affected his history very powerfully, and we're still impacted by it to this day. And there's no doubt about it when you study these things out. In chapter 3, of course, Nebuchadnezzar flat goes crazy and loses his mind. But by the end of his days, in chapter 4, he is confessing God as the sovereign God. And look at Daniel 4, verse 19. Interpreting another dream. Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, was astonished, or, you know, astonished, old word there, for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belshazzar answered, Daniel answered and said, my lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. Now, this interpretation is that you're fixing to lose your kingdom to your son. And this is bothering Daniel. Can you imagine Daniel, a captive, having to deal with all this political turmoil? He's right in the middle of this. He's right in the middle of all of this political empire turning of events from the Babylonians and now going to the Medes and the Persians. He lives through all this, and he actually rises to the top, or, you know, like Joseph in many ways. And then look at verse 22, if you're still in chapter 4. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one coming down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down. Talking about Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel's given the interpretation of this, and this is a major political event. A world event. Don't tell me our God's not in control. We may think over here in little old St. Angelo, Texas, isn't that little compared to where I came from? But nonetheless, we might think we're little and God doesn't really pay attention, doesn't know what's going on. That is so untrue. He knows exactly what's going on as you study through this. And he's talking about how this thing's fixing to be turned around. And look at verse 28. Well, you might look at verse 24. Of course, just go back and read the whole book. But verse 24 says, this is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the king, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass. And this, again, goes crazy, and he lives like an animal, and he goes through this bleak time. And there's some historical, it seems, evidence that points to a time when this guy did go crazy. Look at verse 28. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. In the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built, notice that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. Dude, you're messed up. God's in control. Bible geography. And Daniel lives through all of this. I want you to look at chapter 5 briefly. Notice here again his son and his impious feast. The handwriting on the wall, they're drinking and carousing and having a good old party time. I don't even want to know what's going on. Tells you enough in there to know that it wasn't a good place to be. In verse 5, the same hour came fourth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Of course, How many times have we used that idiom, the handwriting's on the wall, to this day? And that's a biblical idiom that comes from the Bible. And the interpretation of this, of course, Daniel's the only one that could interpret it, and he's sitting there again in the middle of all this. And they summon him up in verse 25, meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Meeny, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Remember I said the Babylonian kingdom doesn't last very long. The Babylonians that had one of the seven wonders of the world, talking about those hanging gardens. You ever heard about the hanging gardens of Babylon? History still talks about those hanging gardens. Lost to time in history. But Babylon was an amazing kingdom for a short period of time. And you can see what happens here, the attitude. God's not going to tolerate this, even today, in principle, this attitude. You keep reading in verse 27, thou art weighed in the balance, balances, and are found wanting, measure of justice. And thy kingdom is divided and given to whom? Look at verse 28. So, there's this short span of time where the Babylonians don't exist and it goes to the Medes and the Persians. Now the Persians were allied with the Grecians. And this goes back to Daniel chapter 2 in the first dream of Nebuchadnezzar that talks about those four particular kingdoms. Babylonians, Medes, Persians, Grecians. And Daniel, if you keep reading through, there's no doubt talking about Alexander the Great. Who was Alexander the Great? Was he a Roman or a Greek? He's a Grecian. And the Grecians rose to power through, again, weakness, frailty. One of the things that we have to remember is the innovation of these people, which is driving this movement. Innovative minds, philosophers. I remember as a kid hearing about Aristotle and Plato and Socrates and all these people, and I thought, well, I don't care anything about all that. We still use Aristotelian logic in our deductive thinking and reasoning. Which I would say, though Aristotle put some laws and defined some things, gave us forms and books to read and study, who gave Aristotle reason? Who gave us all the ability to reason? So it's God. But these men, pagans, yet very sophisticated, where's the word sophistry and sophistication come from? We still use that word all the time, don't we? And that's a Latin, Greek word talking about the sophistry, the wisdom of man and so forth. Paul talks about that in the New Testament. This is all developing. I want you to notice on the screen here, we're going to pass on, but you've got Cyrus's cylinder here. I am Cyrus, king of the universe, it says on this cylinder they found. Their writing was becoming more precise. Their chronicling, their ability to chronicle history. This corresponds with Ezra 1:1. And in this cylinder, 536 BC time frame, he talks about Nabonidus, the king who did not fear me, since the gods of... I have to get over here and see that. I know you can't see it either. I can't even see it. Since the gods of foreign lands made permanent sanctuaries, which are now dilapidated, I returned people to their lands and made provisions to rebuild. 530, that cylinder records the very thing that Ezra, Nehemiah go through this period of time. Again, there's these structures over here, the Babylonian Chronicles of 605 through 594 BC, chronicling the Battle of Carchemish, which is in the Bible. Capture of Jehoiachin and appointment of Zedekiah, who Zedekiah was just a pawn king. He wasn't an appointed king by God. By this time, the nation was gone. They were in captivity. They were already being exited out of the land of promise. And that dates to around March 16, 597. So you have this in correspondence to, again, what Daniel 1:1 says. If you can see some of this, 2 Chronicles 36:21 talks about all this falling through. And so just very interesting part of your Bible that we may not read and study as much as we ought to. And the reason I say that's because of the impact even today upon our modern era or society. Now, just to kind of help put this a little bit in context, the prophets in relationship to the exile. These prophets, if you want to, you probably already know this. I mean, we're reading the reading tree. Prophets before the exile, Obadiah, Joel, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Micah, Nahum, Zephaniah, Habakkuk. During the exile, Babylonian captivity, a 70-year period of time, Jeremiah, Lamentation. Jeremiah was right there at the beginning of it. He experienced that captivity. Daniel, of course, one of the captives. Ezekiel by the river Kebar. He opens up and says, "The river." Now, I don't even know where that is. That's a geographical location. But he was at the river Kebar, and he's receiving revelation from God. And while he's in captivity over in Babylon, what's the message of Ezekiel? When you think about the main message of the entire large prophet of Ezekiel, it's really one thing. Okay, your sons are not necessarily, they're receiving the consequences of your parents' sins. But in Ezekiel 18, it says very clearly that they don't receive the actual sin. But they're in captivity because they're wondering, well, we're in captivity because of all these sins of our fathers. Is there a way out for us? Well, Calvinism says what? What does Roman Catholicism teach about original sin? Babies inherit that sin. And therefore you're cursed forever, you know, and there's no way out. And Ezekiel the prophet says, over in captivity, that's not the case. The righteousness of the righteous precedes him. Their unrighteousness also. But the children are innocent. They're just suffering from consequences. And that's really the story of the book of Ezekiel, if you ask me. It's a principle of consequence. We're over here because of sin and consequence, just as God said. And here's the way out. Don't forget the Messiah. He's coming. Now, I want you to stop and think about this. Because in Babylonia, in this Mede-Persia area, guess what at the same time is being continually preached and propagated during this time? The gospel of Jesus Christ is coming. The message of redemption is being preached in these foreign lands by these prophets. And how do we know what kind of exposure, saturation, if you will, the impact, the implications of this message far reached out? Well, I believe the gospel, as it's even today, commanded to go to the whole world, back then being preached to the whole world then. It was getting out. Now, did they have it all figured out and understood? No. But here's another point. When you get to the wise men who came from where? To see the baby Jesus and followed some star. Miraculous. That wasn't just some astrological event. That was a miraculous thing. Where'd those guys come from? Bible geography. Men of the East. Wise men. These guys that were probably like your Aristotles and people. They were sophistry. These were people in tune. They were readers. They were listening to the various philosophies of the world. They had heard about the Messiah, no doubt, and they came to see him. Which, how many Jews, having been restored to the land of promise, were very interested in going to see him? I know one King Herod in Matthew chapter 2 and chapter 3 that was trying to do what to him? Kill him. And you want to talk about hypocrisy of God's own people. I know the Herodians were interrelated with the Idumeans and Ishmaelites and all that. But nonetheless, they were related and they knew. And do you remember what King Herod in Matthew chapter 2 actually did? He summoned the scholars, the Old Testament or Hebrew Scripture scholars, the scribes. He summoned them and said, come tell me, I want to know what the Bible says. What does the Bible say about where the Messiah will be born? In Matthew chapter 2, the scholars, the scribes opened up the Bible, the scrolls, and would have said, in Bethlehem of Judea. It's recorded there in Matthew. Now why did Matthew record that? He recorded that by inspiration to show the ludicrousy, the hypocrisy of the Jews. You yourselves know. You even told a wicked king, King Herod the Terrible, to the Jews, the great to the world because of his architectural building. You even told him what the right answer was. Why'd you do that if you don't believe it? Why would you reject him? You went to the right source. this Jesus of Nazareth, whom ye have taken by wicked hands and crucified. Peter, by inspiration, had every right to preach that, because it was true. They knew there was no excuse. Anyway, that's all related to what we're trying to talk about and establish. So again, after the exile, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, and we're getting there, getting closer. I don't know if this is interesting or helpful. A lot of your study Bibles will have some of these charts in there. But this is just going to show you kind of a timeline of kings. Of course, over here to the right is the northern kingdom of Israel that goes into Assyrian captivity, never comes back. We talked about Hoshea the other couple weeks ago, and 2 Kings 17, we were there, and it shows him, he's gone. All these kings were wicked on the right side. None of them were good. They were all bad. Of course, going back to Jeroboam, the first split, he says, let's set up false and idolatrous worship. Of course, he didn't call it that at the time. And he says so at Dan and Beth, let's do this thing because we don't want the people of God, we don't want them returning back. So they set up distractions. Same thing today. People do. They set up distractions to distract us from our calling, the gospel. Over here to the left are the southern kings. And we just talked about Jehoiachin going into captivity over here again. These old clay cylinders and writings record this very thing taking place. 2 Kings 24, verse 8, Zedekiah, again, a pawn king. But nonetheless, these kings right here, you know, that's who served. Some good, some better, and not so good either. A lot of them bad. You can see the timeline. Some served 52 years, 55 years, 2 years for this guy. He wasn't very good. So again, that kind of puts it into perspective. And these were known individuals during these days by these threats. Now let's talk about Rome. My promise to myself was I'm going to get to Rome. Remember Daniel's prophecy. I know that this is quick, but Daniel's prophecy prophesied of these rising and falling kingdoms. All right. It's a wonderful, fascinating study, especially when you go and you try to read about Alexander the Great. Anybody know how Alexander the Great came to power according to history? Who controlled the Grecian world or empire? It wasn't really an empire. Do you know who actually controlled Greece? It was run by a Senate. It wasn't an empireship. It wasn't a dictatorship. It was more of a republic in one sense. But do you know who all the senators were? That's significant and key to understanding Greece. The Senate was controlled by the wealthy landowners or families. Okay? And those people were obviously in power. They had land. They had control. They controlled the commerce, the economy. Alexander the Great comes around and guess what he does? Charismatic guy, a lot of history on him. He recognizes the poor. He recognizes the not landowners. And he comes to power, this is very general and basic. He comes to power basically by getting on the good side of the poor people. And he rises up and eventually will lead to having four generals. Those four generals will eventually depart and split up, and you eventually get to a Caesar. And Rome comes out of this. And Rome incorporates the principles of Greece, senatory, republican type of style of government where it's supposed to be ruled by a republican type of senate. Then you get the tyranny, the tyrant, the empire, the emperor, who then becomes deified. And they start to incarnate him as a god. Anyway, very interesting if you like that kind of thing. So let's talk about all roads lead to Rome, or at least from Rome. I phrased it that way because during this day, Rome became so powerful, as Daniel's prophecy talks about, that it was, again, the centerpiece. Remember we talked about these roads? These roads, I've got red here, major Roman roads, were paved roads by the Romans, paved with stone, and we'll talk about that. And these roads had markers all along them. The yellow ones are, again, minor roads, but nonetheless, like your roads today, county roads, you have minor roads, majors, and so forth. You had these legionary camps being established in this promised land area. I'm trying to draw your attention back to the promised land just to show you the Romans had an impact. Around Jerusalem was a legionary camp. Up here around Galilee, there's a legionary camp there, no doubt about it. And the Romans began to really infiltrate. Over here to the right, you probably can barely see this. This is a marker, a road marker that is dotted all along this ancient world that talks about this will get you back to Rome. Go this way, go that way, take a right here, take a left there, and you'll get back to Rome. This is, of course, a cobblestone or type of road that they built. There's that large and large. We have street signs today. Before the Romans, no other empire had gone throughout the world and done this. Now, I want you to think about the unification, uniting of a world by doing this, how ingenious it was. Give them some road maps. Give them some details. But in all of this, always remind them on every one of these little markers that all these roads lead back to who? To Rome. And every one of them said that. Rome becomes very articulate. One of the advancements during this day and age is the ability to communicate, as I said, with people like Aristotle. He created the ideas. He didn't create them. I'm sorry, I just said that. That's not right. He formulated the ideas that already existed. He put them into forms and made it where we could understand why we actually think the way we think. Things that we do all the time we don't ever think about. Drawing implications, deductions, inductive logic, based upon environments and circumstances. And there's only so many steps before you run out of options and now you're into the field of, well, we don't know, guesswork. They became very reasonable from the standpoint of reason. One of the things that made Rome great, coming out of the Grecians, was what is, as according to Aristotle and Plato, what is the common good? There is a commonality amongst all of us. What is the common good? What do we all need? What do we all need versus want? That argument was heavy back then. The government capitalized on that, the Caesars and various others, and said, you know what? Everybody needs what? What does everybody need still today? Need versus want. Well, that's true. But let's talk about fundamental physical needs. Food, shelter, safety, economy, need a way to work, provide. We don't want to be the sole provider, but did you know Rome had a welfare system that took care of their citizenry? I'm going to take 3-4 more minutes here until 10:15, and I'm going to quit. Rome was masterful. You've got to see that. What is it that makes our government work today? When you look at that government, what is it that made that government work then that also led to the failure of that government and will also lead to the failure of our government today? You'll see the connections. And it's all tied to the land. This is how they built roads, and I'm going to end on this. They'd come in here, of course, nothing. You guys like doing landscaping. Sometimes you'll come down here, you'll find a little bit of a bedrock or a stronger layer. Come in with some sand or pea gravel type material, pack it down. Anybody ever laid out like sidewalks and stepways through your yard and you'll come in, put some sand down, dig it out, level it out and so forth. They did the same things. And then they come back with the larger stone. They had a border. Tied it all in tight and they built their roads. How important are roads today? You remember when they invented cars? Remember old Ford? Remember one of the first problems they were trying to figure out? Remember what kind of wheels and tires did they have on the first cars? And back then, late 1800s, early 1900s, some of these guys were saying, Forget that. I'm going back to the horse that's got a big old hoof and get through this stuff. And then what'd they do? They started realizing we got to build some roads because we can't, these little bitty wheels and tires. And of course, over time we've expanded and we've learned how to get through. Again, just very common. There's a still existent road. You can see the border. You can see the stone nicely laid out. Notice how the seams are not just in parallel fashion. They adjacent to one another, kind of, or they set them off for locking it in. They were such builders that these roads still exist, a lot of them. And that in advance. Now, you might be thinking, well, Brian, why are we talking about roads and dirt and all that stuff? I'm talking about this because of the advancement of the gospel. In the first century, guess what this enabled? All roads lead to, where do we end up into the end of the book of Acts? Paul's in Rome. The book of Romans. Paul writing to them saying, I long to be with you so I can impart unto you spiritual gifts. So until the end of the New Testament first century period of time, the infancy period, you can be established because the Bible was starting to be written. So we're going to talk about this advancement. This is the last on this, and we'll have a lot to talk about Wednesday night, Lord willing. Milestones. Jesus talks about, in principle, the having to go 1 mile, 2 mile with the Romans in the Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Anyway, it's often been said all roads lead to Rome, and this was correct in the time of Jesus. Actually, all roads led from Rome because the Roman Forum, Romanium, marked the starting point, and every road was measured from it, from the gilded pillar that Caesar Augustus had placed there. The roads were clearly marked with milestones from the eternal city. Eternal city. No pilgrim or merchant could ever forget that he journeyed upon an imperial road. The Roman mile was 1,500 meters or 1,000 paces, and it was marked with milestones. Milli is Latin for 1,000. And today, a lot of people are wanting to be a millionaire. You can see the connection there. Anyway. All right, I hope I didn't bore you to death. But nonetheless, we'll stop there and we'll pick up and talk about Rome more and the Bible. I've got some very good Bible passages that'll help tie all this in. Thank you for your attention.